Hi, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lens of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. So why are we doing this? Like everyone in these special times, we're looking to do things differently. We're taking the conversation online. I'm not only a huge fan, but also an avid participant in the global tech conversation, and wanted to give listeners a candid look at how things were shaping up for folks on the front lines. Over the course of the show, we give listeners a chance to meet some of the diverse players who are trying to figure it out. You'll not only hear what they're wrestling with, but also how they got here and why it's important. We're starting this series by digging into a buzzword we've been hearing a lot of coming out of the diplomats here in Silicon Valley. Techplomacy, or tech diplomacy. Denmark made a splash in 2017 with the advent of the world's first tech ambassadorship. The idea of the role rests on the claim that big tech platforms are the equivalent of nation states and require diplomatic treatment. The concept of the tech diplomat rests on this idea that the trillion-dollar-plus globe-spanning tech platforms are different in kind and not just degree from previous behemoth corporations. It's an argument we've become familiar with. Big tech is able to shape markets, mindsets, and condition consumer and democratic choices in ways that outstrip the capacity and tools of government. The shifting and unbalanced power dynamics between tech and government is a theme we'll come back to throughout the series. To talk about it, we sit down with Denmark's current global tech ambassador, based here in Silicon Valley.
Hi, my name is Anne-Marie Larsen. I am Denmark's tech ambassador in Silicon Valley.
What is techplomacy, and how did Denmark come to take this on as a diplomatic role? And maybe you could tell me a little bit about the evolution since you've got into the role.
If we're kind of looking at diplomacy in waves, first wave came after the Westphalian Peace, 1648, the creation of nation states and the understanding that even when nation states are at war and conflict, we need some people that can speak to each other behind enemy lines. They speak the same language, they understand each other, they have a whole set of procedures and ways of engaging that is, if not almost like a secret codex, but one that is recognized across every single nation state and allows for this continuous dialogue, whether it is on good terms or also in terms of you know, challenging times. And I think that really laid the groundwork for how sovereign states were interacting with each other. How we're influencing, you know, Denmark is a small country, not least in comparison with Canada, but how a small country like Denmark that's very dependent on an open economy, globalized connection with the rest of the world, how do we make our influence in such a big world? Then kind of move into the second wave, I think after World War II, we're seeing multilateralism. So rather than just having diplomats to nation states, we start having diplomats to international bodies, because this is where transformation is taking place. This is where we're seeing an impact on the lives of ordinary Danes, on the ability of our markets to function, of our society to work. And so we start sending people to Geneva, to Brussels, to New York, understanding that that is where the kind of foreign diplomatic transformation is taking place for a small country like Denmark. And now techplomacy is really the third wave. So third wave diplomacy in a, you know, kind of looking back 400 years, now we realize that transformation is no longer defined by what other nation states are doing. It's no longer only defined what international organizations are doing, but we recognize that there are companies, individual companies, who hold immense power over the lives of Danish citizens, our future markets, our labor markets, our opportunities in this world, the way our democracy function, the way our societies function, down to the very question of what does it mean to be a human being today. And so in the realization of that, we saw, well, we need to have diplomats where that change has taken place, where transformation is happening. And yes, it's not within a defined geographical border of a nation state. And it's also not within the kind of confined space of a UN building in New York. Now it has also taken place in an industry with companies, with people who don't necessarily, you know, look or speak like diplomats. They're not trained in the bureaucracy like the classic diplomats are. But the way that they conduct their business, the way that they make decisions on how their technologies are impacting for good and for bad the world that we live in, have you know, massive, massive implications for how we live our lives and for what opportunities we have in the future. So that was a realization that led Denmark back in 2017 to start the creation of what is now our technological diplomacy.
And how has that changed over the course of the last 3 or 4 years? How has it shifted for Denmark? Because I noticed that since you've had one iteration of it, and now you're into a second iteration with your mandate, and you've recently put out a paper describing some of the things that Denmark is looking to do with this. And so can you just walk us through some of that evolution of Denmark's thinking in this space?
Lots have happened. I think when we look at the grand scale of diplomacy, in December last year, the foreign ministry in Denmark, we celebrated the 250 years anniversary. And you know, in that perspective, 4 years is a very short time. So I say that we're still figuring this space out. That's why I'm so delighted to see many more countries now have appointed tech ambassadors, cyber ambassadors, tech envoys, because learning from like-minded countries, collaborating with like-minded countries, I think is what's really going to make this endeavor not only robust, but also successful. That being said, some of the changes that I think you can talk to, or some of the evolutions that have happened in the way we do diplomacy, one is that in 2017, the world just looked a little different. I was working at the World Economic Forum, the first meeting in Davos where we discussed the fourth industrial revolution. That was in 2016. I remember in 2017, the conversations around technologies were super optimistic. I think the most challenging panel we had at Davos in 2017 was whether robots are going to take our jobs. Given there was a paper coming out from Oxford University at the time that would say, you know, we're all going to be automated. But that was really the extent of it. The rest of it was the potential of flying cars, how this would solve climate change. You know, I remember everyone was trying and testing these VR glasses and was super excited about it. And then fast forward to the last Davos I had at the World Economic Forum, if that can, you know, serve as a proxy for how the world thinks about these things, it was incredibly critical. A lot more discussions on what are the challenges around bias and, you know, sexism and racism and AI. Some of the massive cyber attacks that we saw playing out in 2017, 2018, but we really didn't grasp fully until 2019, NotPetya, WannaCry, how that impacted industries and how they started coming out with that. To the questions of, you know, what happened on the Capitol on January 6th, not least the decision that came out by Facebook Oversight Board today, has translated into conversation with Danish policymakers, Danish citizens on, is this fundamentally undermining our democracy or is it strengthening it? Is this giving voice to the voiceless or is it taking it away? Is this challenging the development of our children to a degree that we, you know, are conducting this massive social experiment where we allow them to spend countless hours every day on a medium where we don't really know what the long-term effects is for their well-being and development? So this change, I think, is really a contextual change. And that's why with the new strategy, what we're really trying to is to show how can a small country like Denmark, not only through traditional diplomacy, such as creating dialogue, meaning, understanding, conversation, but also on 21 more or less specific KPIs, show what impact we can have in this space in 3 years. Because this transformation is going so incredibly fast. And I think if we are to actually gain the support and the trust of citizens, not only in our diplomacy, but in how technology is shaping their worlds and lives, it requires us to show and deliver results.
So we can look to Denmark as an example of how techplomacy has evolved, but we also need to look beyond that. Multilateral diplomats sitting in Brussels, Paris, Geneva, and New York have been seized by the role and impact of tech for years, often drawing from a framework of how tech impacts human rights. To get a global perspective and better understanding of the intersection of tech and human rights, we sit down with Peggy Hicks in Geneva and ask her what the role of the UN is in the current landscape of techplomacy.
I'm Peggy Hicks, the Director of Thematic Engagement, Special Procedures, and Right to Development Division of the UN's Human Rights Office. We are at a moment where human rights globally are under incredible threat. And while there's been enormous progress on many fronts throughout the 20th century and now 21st, so looking at where we're heading, it's not an optimistic picture for many. And you know, all sorts of indicators on that front. The annual survey by Freedom House on the level of democracy worldwide has started to tip downwards, you know, freedom of speech globally. But of course, global challenges like climate change as well and its impact on human rights and the impact of migration globally. There's so many different issues that we're seeing, you know, real and growing threats. But for me, one of the things that has really led to my personal focus on the intersection of technology and human rights is just a firm belief that technology is the tipping point. Will we be able to sort of continue that progress in the next century and continue to make a world in which more people are able to live with their basic human rights respected? Or are we going to head the other direction? And unless we get tech right, I'm very, very wary of the direction that we're heading.
Peggy points out that most technology challenges that we face are able to be placed into three categories. The first one being the rights to privacy and non-discrimination.
For me, I'd say that we tend to group some of the technology challenges that we face into at least three or four different baskets. One is around the rights to privacy and non-discrimination. That can be two baskets or one. So how do we see the challenges that are posed by surveillance and other technologies that like facial recognition that can really change how we live our lives in many ways? The second basket relates to democracy, really, and democratic systems. And within that, the rights to free assembly and freedom of expression. We see all sorts of issues around trying to make sure that people are able to really continue to engage in their ability to elect governments and engage with their governments in the ways that make democracies work. And if we don't get some of those things going better, we see some real threats there. And then we also really look at issues facing the digital divide. So the fact that half the globe doesn't have connection to the internet and to some of the digital technologies that are so important in our lives now. And what does that mean for global inequality and issues around social access to basic social and economic rights as well? And I sort of buried the point about non-discrimination and equality, but that to us is also a critical theme that runs through all of those areas. How do we ensure that the use of new technologies does not exacerbate existing inequalities and further discrimination in a variety of ways?
To recap, the three areas of focus are the rights to privacy and non-discrimination, democracy and freedom of expression, and the digital divide. With these important areas in mind, we look to Anne-Marie to understand what she thinks the role of tech ambassadors is in 2021. What do you envision the role of tech ambassadors right now versus, say, 2017 and potentially into 2022, 2023, 2024? What do you see it as?
One of the main objectives, I think, is to build confidence in governments. If governments is to successfully take a steer and be much more at the, you know, driver's seat of steering where this technological revolution is unfolding, it requires confidence. I think it requires, and that confidence has to build on a deeper understanding, a true insight, a holistic and nuanced appreciation of both the possibilities of technologies and how it is used, being used and applied for good, while at the same time, much more thoroughly understanding the shadow side. So much of what I see my role is in terms of kind of when it comes back to what do I bring back to Denmark is part of building that confidence. Because if we don't get that confidence, you know, I think we're going to see what happened in the past two decades is that we forgot to regulate. This was always too technical. This is not really our domain, or, you know, the market will fix this, to now we're at a place where we have, you know, very strong monopolies. We're having companies in a size that we haven't dealt with before. I think this is another thing. Like, we can't just, I think there's a lot to be said around how we're using antitrust. And I think a lot of the competition cases, both here in the US and the EU, are really setting a new precedent for how we're addressing this. I think there's also a question that we probably need to update our antitrust toolbox a little bit, because the size of these companies are unprecedented. This is no longer to do with the price of for the individual consumer, because most of these products are free, at least in kind of a traditional sense. So I think by building that confidence, it will help governments and policymakers to be much more at the steering wheel of this. So many conversations I've been in, there's this idea that, you know, governments are these, you know, antiquated, outdated boomers that don't understand technology. They ask, you know, stupid questions. And while that might have been true for some of the congressional hearings that we heard in 2019, it is a different place now. And not just here in the U.S., in Denmark, in Europe, I think politicians, policymakers, governments, bureaucrats, with a much more nuanced, realistic understanding of this issue, that are much more able to actually take action.
So a lot has changed in the last 2 years. Governments, politicians, and policy leaders have a much more nuanced understanding of what needs to be done. Peggy agrees and asks governments to do more.
In terms of what governments can do, I do think it is that step of not taking the shortcuts, doing the hard work to bring in human rights. And I do think reaching out more and trying to close that divide with the tech conversations that are happening in Latin America and Africa and the Mideast and elsewhere is going to be really important. And I think there are way too many panels and events and things that I'm engaged in that really don't bring in those perspectives of the impact that some of these issues are having on the ground today in other parts of the world.
What do you see as the role of your office in places like Silicon Valley, where a lot of the ideation, leadership, early stage thinking around development of technology and the funding of technology, but also not a political center in a traditional way?
We've had a learning curve in that ourselves. I mean, this is certainly a space where the ways in which human rights in general, the type of language that we use and the way that the UN works, the somewhat bureaucratic and somewhat slow processes that we sometimes have are not well suited to engage effectively in Silicon Valley. So we've been really working to up our game as well. The piece of it that we're not to yet, but that we're really trying to get to, is that how do we move from a place where each company has its own standards, its own approaches to identifying and dealing with an issue like hate speech, for example, how do we actually have some consistent engagement across the platforms and some potential approach that means that they're all abiding by standards that, at least within their industry, are ones that they have agreed and for which there are consequences for violating. So that idea of co-regulation is something that we're really interested in pursuing. And we do see some interest from the companies. There are also, of course, there's a big antitrust thread going through these conversations as well. But the reality is it does none of us any good if no one understands the standards relating to speech, for example, that are being applied by the different platforms. And if those standards are all different, it actually makes it even harder for the users and consumers. So, you know, trying to be an agent that can bring together some of those conversations between companies is also something we're really interested going forward.
Not only is the UN working more closely with tech companies, governments are too. What's a kind of a typical interaction look like for you with companies right now?
A lot of our conversation with them is on a continuous building, I think, a trustful relationship. They have been, you know, adding more diplomats. They have been, you know, strengthening their public diplomacy efforts. And I think in that sense, they are realizing it's not a matter whether they're going to be regulated or not. It's a matter of how and when. And so in that sense, there is, I think, an increased open door for people like you and I. The second one is then, so what do we do with that conversation? How do we translate that into a true public-private collaboration, whether that is on legislation and right now, obviously, with the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act in Europe, and how that is kind of trickling down. International legislation is one piece, but we recognize that they won't cover everything. So in the meantime, how do we address some of these issues? How do we find ways of working that? They are addressing, you know, how our children and youth unsupervised using some of these platforms where it's not meaningfully contributing to their lives. What are we addressing in terms of cyber? So what we're using that conversation for and building a trustful relationship with the tech industry around is exactly to have I think, an invitation to find much more of these partnerships. And that's what we try to set out in the strategy. A number of them actually point to say, this is where we will try to form partnerships or alliances around specific topics where we hope we can find a solution with tech companies. We're still in the early days of this. So, you know what, let's check in a year from now and we'll see whether we have been somewhat successful or not. But this is actually our attempt is to build a stronger collaboration and not just having the conversation.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that I often characterize that, the first phase of the conversation, which, you could maybe typify from like post 2015 onwards, was a problem identification challenge. And so it was, everyone and every problem seemed to align into the other problem. So a privacy issue was a security issue. And it was very unclear as to how you can grapple with a solution set if every problem started to, look the same. And the second phase was really a distillation and lane formation of the conversation. And so we started to have very in-depth global conversations at regulatory levels, at national levels, at multilateral levels about situations like privacy. And, some of that obviously was impacted by major events. But that creation of lanes has happened in a significant way. And now we're into arguably this third phase, which is this solution building phase.
In order to get to solutions, we really need to understand what pain points we're addressing.
What are the major surface areas that you see in this next year that are priorities for Denmark and for yourself? And what kind of forums are you looking at to be most effective in, creating these solutions so they go from conversations to solutions?
I think for Denmark in the coming year and looking at the strategy, the most important issues, one is going to be around this whole question of democracy. This is the first time in my lifetime that I remember us having conversations around whether this is going to continue. Should we be afraid that democracy will somehow fall? I grew up in Denmark and always had this, this was just there. You didn't really question it. So this conversation around is, are our democracies more fragile because of the way that technology has impacted our democracy? And I think that also ties into the question around globalization, which is also the first time in my lifetime that we are even, questioning globalization, but that's a much longer discussion. But that requires us, we need to look at this. And this is not only when it comes to disinformation, malicious campaigns by non-state and state actors. It is also the question of what is our conversation online? What is our dialogue? How do we understand each other? How do we speak to each other? How do we engage and interact? So that is one piece. The second one is around children and youth online. And that is definitely not a traditional diplomatic topic. I recognize that. But I think right now, as I said before, we're conducting this massive experiment with children and youth and how it plays out online. And I think we need to very, very seriously and very fast try to find some solutions and understanding much more what does that actually do. And then thirdly, there is this question of responsibility. What is the responsibility of a company when you are incredibly large, unprecedentedly big, have an impact that is spanning not just on one tiny issue, but across a whole range of issues and topics? So based on these three, what we're working on is a number of initiatives. One is kind of exploring a larger democracy initiative that will gather both countries, civil society, companies in a collaboration and try to come up with some of these partnerships for democracy online, addressing questions of children and youth, and quite willing to put skin in the game. Because I think at my time at the World Economic Forum, I worked with public-private partnerships, and the ones where someone is just demanding what they want and then hoping someone else will come into that partnership and then deliver what they want is not a partnership. It requires both parties, I think, to realize there are trade-offs. You need to have skin in the game. So that's what we're doing on that front. The same when it comes to children and youth. We are having conversations now with a number of the very large platforms and quite interested in forming, could we, even at first, if it's a paper identifying what could some of the solutions be, could we test and trial some of these in Denmark? Not within, classic legislation, but on a, collaborative model. What could that model look like? So that is another thing that we're looking at. And then when it comes to the kind of larger societal responsibility, working on two things. So one thing we put out in our strategy is the idea of a European Tech Alliance, because there's no question. I spend a lot of my time and focus on the very large companies, the GAF plus, but technology is so much more. And I think we're missing the point if we only look at who's large now, and also not looking who could be dominating in various spheres and what maybe in a somewhat more responsible way in the future.
Again, with human rights as the basis for conversation, there's a huge question about the impact of authoritarianism on the global digital ecosystem.
What do you make of this conversation that is starting to emerge in a whole set of multilateral and national circles around a division between authoritarian technology states and non-authoritarians, and the creation of new institutions, potentially, like a T12 or some form of grouping of democratic states?
I come at it from a perspective that we bring to these conversations quite a bit on the human rights side, which is that one of the advantages of using the human rights framework is that we don't play into those divisions as much, that the standards that apply to every government, because we obviously see actions that could be labeled authoritarian in governments that call themselves democracies all the time. We have a lot of countries in the middle that have tendencies in both directions. And then obviously, even within countries that, you know, there might be general agreement are largely authoritarian, all those countries have agreed to the basic principles of the UN's treaties relating to human rights. And so it gives us a platform where we can say, this is the common ground on which we're going to work. And we will try to make sure that we use that platform to have at least a system where, you know, it doesn't always work in practice, but where there is at least a common agreement on some of the guides and principles that will be used in terms of how we develop. That said, I think there is a lot of space for governments that have similar ideas, similar platforms relating to how they're approaching new technologies to do a much better job of coming together and advancing these issues in a way that sets standards and models that are good ones to replicate. I have to say, you know, we've seen a number of examples, and we've talked about them, of governments rushing to legislate issues in ways that tends to be overbroad and suppresses rights and isn't necessarily effective in addressing the challenges that governments are trying to address. So we're really looking to democratic governments to make sure that they're very aware of that, the fact that whatever bar they set, it's going to be the high bar globally. And so if they start from a very, you know, the lowest common denominator place, we're going to have a world where a lot worse things are going to happen in other contexts.
How do you see that divide? You've got offices in both places. You have discussions with the Chinese government and other players. How are you seeing this space evolve right now?
Too fast. And I think from the perspective of a person who's very, very proud and very happy to have grown up in a democracy, I think it's going the wrong way. And it's going too fast. When we see the decline of democracies, the rise of autocracies, and the question, I think even worse, is question the democratic ideal, question democratic values. And to me, that says that we haven't been good enough, I think, of sharing. So why does democracy work? What is it that it delivers? And I think it comes back to this question that globalization over the past three decades probably haven't delivered enough for everyone, particularly living in those democracies. So now I see more than ever a need for democracies to come much stronger together. That's why I've been, you know, the transatlantic partnership. And that is not only, of course, with the Biden administration, but also with Canada, a stronger alliance with Europe on these issues is so necessary. And for a long time, we talked about the splinter net. We talked about the three different ways, from the kind of state-centered Chinese model to tech developed and the market oriented model of the US, and then the kind of citizen oriented model of Europe that could regulate but couldn't come up with any products or services. I think that we need to go beyond that now, because if we keep seeing it as a race between the three, I think North America, I think Europe is going to lose that simply. And it's not just in terms of getting to the market with products and services, it's potentially on the whole model and values on which our technological systems are built. So by starting to see much more, what do we have in common between North America and Europe? Cheering thoughts in abstract, lofty things that we've been, you know, telling ourselves was so great for such a long time. How do we translate that to better lives, more meaningful lives, more sustainable lives, better opportunities for everyone everywhere? And that's why I very much hope to see a stronger transatlantic collaboration on this and with like-minded countries around the world. That being said, we still have an office. I believe it's important that we continue dialogue with China, the European approach to China as both a partner, a competitor, and a rival, I think takes a very nuanced and balanced approach to this, because I think that is our strongest way to also speaking on some of the global governance issues that we still need to find some global solutions for.
Clearly, you're dealing with a much bigger template. You're dealing with the rest of the world. You're dealing with, you know, with not just Europe, but also sort of emerging democracies in different contexts around the world. And I wonder how you're balancing those multiple perspectives right now.
Oh, it's a good question, because it's one that we struggle with. And if we're struggling with it, we know that others are as well, including the governments that we work with. The reality is we see, you know, enormous challenges for democracy and for groups that are engaged in democracy in the digital environment right now. So as crucial as some of the challenges are in terms of the managing of content online and addressing counterterrorism and cybersecurity, what we see is sort of a global movement to use some of that legislation to suppress dissent and to ensure that those who have views that are in opposition or otherwise controversial or sensitive are taken down and worse, of course. What we see is that people are being arrested and detained on the basis of online speech on a routine basis under legislation which is also often incredibly broad and enforced in very discriminatory ways. So I think our first line issue is that we are very concerned about the extent to which regulation of some of these spaces is going to lead to models of legislative approaches and crackdowns that will actually undermine the ability of people to really have a democratic role in their governments. And that means, you know, we use this term civic space, but what space is there for people to actually engage in their own government in an effective way in the policy making that it's doing, or to critique it, or to come together with their neighbors to try to push for change in one way or another. And we see that as a really big threat. What we see, for example, is that the online space has become a space that's really unsafe for those who are trying to make change happen in their societies. And, you know, we've always, as an organization, the UN Human Rights Office, one of our big concerns has been human rights defenders. And I think we have a great methodology in place for how we respond to physical attacks on human rights defenders. But what we see now is that toolkit isn't helping when what's happening is that human rights defenders are attacked in a variety of different ways online. And those attacks sometimes lead to offline violence. But even when they don't directly lead to that, they lead to censoring or chilling of speech in one way or another, so that people are not able to play the roles as human rights defenders that we want them to be able to play. So that's one big set of issues that's important to us. At the same time, the flip side of that is that without better engagement in terms of how we are regulating the use of these technologies, and in particular the social media environment, it is that double-edged sword where too much takedown is going to impact on rights one way, but leaving everything up means that those threats and that harassment and those attacks are all there, and that people are endangered in one space or the other. So there aren't simple answers, but the reality is that the human rights framework is the best framework we have to try to find that pathway that allows us to protect people and their free expression and their ability to engage with their governments, while at the same time providing a safe space to do it. And there's all sorts of things within human rights law that give us, you know, the tools to use. So, you know, if you're going to restrict speech, you have to do it in the, you know, the a way that's the least intrusive. You know, it has to be proportionate to the threat that you see. There has to be transparency around it. It has to be non-discriminatory. So all of those standards being brought into the way that we regulate speech is going to be really important.
For people watching this space, particularly in Canada, the European Union, and the United States, tech regulation is moving in the right direction, particularly in addressing potential harms and issues of competition. But in order to solve complex problems, what we really need to do in the tech diplomacy space is to start to connect the dots between major issues like cybersecurity, climate change, and resilience. Anne-Marie agrees.
I'm of the view that the areas that I still find that, you know, need to be better joined to the conversation that we're having and often we have in these spheres is, one is around security and resilience and the joining the cyber conversation, the security conversation, the climate conversation to the things that we are trying to do, because they all get conjoined at one level, and they have all of them have a tech surface to them. And so it's I think that having those conversations are also quite important. If you're seeing that in your work.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think we're still in terms of, I agree that is where we need to be. I don't think we're there yet. I mean, I still see, you know, technology or tech diplomacy at times it still figures as this, you know, peripheral thing that isn't necessarily to the core of what's happening in multilateral organizations or even at kind of government level. I think the combination, particularly between security and climate change, and seeing that with the lens of cybersecurity and technology, I think a lot of work still has to be done. I was delighted to see the NATO 2030 report looking at emerging and disruptive technologies started to connect some of those links, started to connect the dots in that. One of the ways that we're trying to work, not least both with the European Union and with the NATO alliance, is also on, can we bring industry, global perspectives from tech diplomacy to the table in terms of helping create those links. I think we're starting to see it in some of the UN conversations. It also featured, if not prominently, then at least featured in the digital roadmap. So the Secretary General's digital roadmap and now with the Office of the Tech Envoy. But I do think that we're still in early days in terms of actually seeing, I think, a proper, much more holistically connected. I mean, the question that we still have to argue that the rule of law also applies online. I mean, that is a pretty crazy thing to even question. Or we have to argue that human rights, you know, equally hold online. That it's not maybe, or it's not, yeah, but with these changes, no, it is 100%. And the fact that we're still, I think, in that space tells us that, one, we have a lot of work to do. Two, one of the I think the important diplomatic efforts is trying to connect those dots. And doing that across, you know, in my own, it's obviously across ministries, with government, but also with the various ecosystems. It's doing it in our international organizations. And then really it is, I think, with one of the ways that we as tech diplomats, I think, can really help leverage this is by, you know, through joint collaboration, through conversation, through projects, whatever it might be, start to highlighting some of these connections.
Peggy agrees that in order to address the issues of technology, we need to work together. We look to Peggy to understand why the concept of the digital divide isn't more central to the conversation we're having around technology and diplomacy right now.
No, I'm glad we're talking about it because I think it's so important, yet it's not in the center of these conversations sometimes the way that it needs to be. So much of the work that we do, I have to be frank, focuses on, you know, Silicon Valley, Western companies, or the alternative, you know, what's happening in China, what's happening elsewhere. but a lot of times the rest of the world isn't really included in the discussion in the way that it needs to be. The effort on the digital divide is really center to what the Secretary General outlined in his roadmap for digital cooperation. The pieces of it that we're looking at are the areas where the divide is more based on discrimination or people being left behind than on simply a resource or technology issue. So in a society where there is the capacity, but certain communities don't have the same access. Some of the people that are most affected by the digital divide are women, that women have less access to the internet. So how can we bring that into our programming? And then at the same time, recognizing that we haven't solved the digital divide, the other piece of work that we do is really try to make sure that when governments are using digital technologies, they're really compensating for, mitigating for, addressing the impact that those approaches can have on communities that may be in some way left behind or disenfranchised by the use of those technology. You know, recognizing that unless we have sufficient safeguards in place, it could exacerbate the worst off, maybe the left even further behind. So those are the two pieces of it we're most focused on now.
We've seen from our own personal experiences and conversations that there's a shift happening. For instance, the recent explosion of cryptocurrencies anticipates a new kind of decentralized ecosystem that will be built on blockchain technology. There are new surface areas emerging that are even more complex than the ones we're currently dealing with.
You know, I remember it's almost like, you know, the Burning Man community would talk about distributed ledger and how it would all, you know, ultimately free us in this, you know, incredibly way that we couldn't even imagine. To know is, you know, I come home and my dad was asking me whether he should buy Bitcoin. So I think we're actually seeing kind of a conversation moving from Silicon Valley down to ordinary citizens. What I see as my role and our role in this is to help translate into much more richer discussion of what type of future could we imagine. I think that we're missing the point with technologies. We simply think about how can this make my life, you know, a tiny bit more efficient or a tiny bit easier or a tiny bit more funnier, rather than saying this has a transformative potential to fundamentally change the way in which our systems operate, in ways in which what it means to be a human, in ways that we can understand things such as love and relationships and work and, you know, task and requirements and duties. So by translating into a conversation of what type of society would we ideally love to live in, and then how can we use technology to ultimate. And so I think it's one of the more untraditional diplomatic endeavors that you and I have right now is thinking, how do we take this current gridlock conversation about people are starting to fear tech into a space of all the potential? What is it required to unleash that potential, and then what can that lead to?
You know, it's interesting. I think that we've found ourselves into that classic Silicon Valley conversation, which it ultimately ends up in transhumanism, and where we ask the big questions at the end. And I think that's actually the genius of this place in some ways, is that it is asking very big questions.
We are asking big questions, but Silicon Valley can be very insular, and we need to be more inclusive.
If this is to become a truly empowering technological future for everyone everywhere, we need to recognize who's currently not here. And one of the things that, you know, moving to the U.S. and also seeing these trends taking place in Europe is conversations around Black Lives Matter, conversations globally around the climate movement, giving voice to young people, the conversations around the digital divide, particularly in developing countries. I think we're starting to see not just a desire, but a demand and need to be part of that decision, of that conversation. So, you know, I remain optimistic here 7 months into my term in Silicon Valley. And not least to be guided and have these wonderful discussions with colleagues like you. Thank you.
Peggy thinks we need to have tools that help us have these conversations globally, though from a different perspective.
Look, there's one example I have to throw out of my, you know, somebody asked me in an interview once, like, what's the one, you know, new tech thing that you want to be invented that will really change the world? And for me, it's actual capacity that allows for simultaneous translation from, you know, all the world's languages immediately. So the movies where you see the person and they're speaking and they just speak to you in your language, even though they're actually speaking in their language. I mean, to me, that would change the way we operate globally and dealing with the cost of trying to get decent translation all the time here. It's one of those big changes.
Gene Roddenberry sort of Star Trek, sort of the first or the second generation, you know, type of technology, I think, right?
It would be so great, you know, but if we had that, we'd understand each other so much better. I mean, so much is communication, I think. But that's one positive thing. I mean, when we look at what's out there that we're worried about and where we see things going, we haven't talked about climate change. And for us, the environment and the impact on the environment and how we address those impacts, I think is a huge question that we want to deal with. We also see within the global sphere that, you know, the conversations around technology tend to be very siloed as well. You know, there's a conversation, as you said, on the cybersecurity, cybercrime area, and we've got conversation on technical standards, and we've got a conversation on counterterrorism or on AI or on digital ID. But we're not actually linking those things up as effectively as we need to. And again, I know I'm a bit of a zealot on the human rights framework, but I think there are, you know, tools like how you do the right type of due diligence, asking all of us to think more about what the impacts of what we're doing are when we're engaging with new technologies. I mean, Facebook, of course, is infamous for the, you know, move fast and break things motto, which, of course, they've since moved past, at least. But the reality is that mindset is still there, that, you know, if it's new, and if it's tech, it's something that we want to roll out as quickly as we can. And we really need to get to a place where there's a different view on that, where we work together as a society to think through some of the impacts of these things, not in a way that stifles innovation, but actually promotes innovation towards things that will really add the right type of value to our human relationships and to the world in which we live.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some fresh perspectives. My takeaway from today is techplomacy is evolving. We're in the midst of a messy phase where literacy in these conversations is growing on all sides. Traditional diplomacy is adapting to create new infrastructure to fit the challenge. Human rights links the tech conversation to an older, well-understood framework that took a century to evolve. And amidst this context, making the case for how human beings are actually affected by our new normal is important. Lots of energy will be spent on the new geopolitics emerging around tech and the divide between authoritarian and democratic models. Across this work, staying focused on the human impact may be the through line. If you want to learn more, we've included some resources in our show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Peggy Hicks and Anne-Marie Engtoft-Larsen for being my guests. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yves Beaulieu, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Ali Sirwa. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. See you next episode.